Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and I hope everybody's doing well today. Thursday, May 28th. And with this recording, that's the second recording for today. But in the episode count, that's 223 episodes on our little channel here. And my guest today spent over three decades inside some of the most consequential software products ever built. He managed the Adobe Acrobat team through the formative years, then joined Google and eventually took the helm of one of the most used language tool on the planet, Google Translate. 500 million people every month were relying on what his team built. And the chapter that I find absolutely fascinating in his journey is what happened inside the team around 2016 when they had to make a call and throw everything they had to construct a statistical machine translation and bet the entire product on neural network. McDuff Hughes led the transition. He navigated the organizational, technical, human complexity for that leap forward. And then he had to do it all over again when LLM era has arrived. He retired in 2024 after 35 years in this industry. And I want to understand with you and the audience today what it looked like inside that room. McDuff, welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat. Glad to have you with me. And let's get into it.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much. If you don't mind, as we start with every conversation on the channel, McDuff, the easy one first. I guess they're all going to be easy today. I'm not going to throw any curveball at you, I promise. The first question is, where are you from? What is your story? What got you here? If you don't mind, for the audience who don't know you, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I'm mostly from California. I've been in California since I was high school. I started computer programming in high school. I just thought computers were really cool and got the chance to learn about them. I went to college and intended to be a math major, ended up getting a degree in philosophy, which involved a lot of study of philosophy of language, something that interested me a lot and didn't seem career relevant at all at the time. I worked my way through college by doing programming during the summers, so I kept my computer skills sharp. Did a couple of years of graduate school. That wasn't a very good experience for me, and I decided that was not my future. So I needed a job. So I went into computer programming full time, and 35 years later, I stopped. So along the way, I worked, as you mentioned, I was one of the managers on the Acrobat team, where I helped get Adobe Acrobat into professional publishing and into official government archiving. Those were some exciting applications of the technology. Then I went to Google, where I spent the last 17 years, and which the most exciting and crowning experience of my career was the 12 years on the Google Translate team, where I had the incredible good fortune to be there as first neural machine translation and then general purpose AIs came and transformed the product. So I was responsible for leading the team that turned those technologies into useful products and tried to make them good for as many people as we could. And it was a really exciting and wonderful experience.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure meeting you when I was in San Francisco, and that's how at the Global Saki event, and that's how for the audience, that's how this podcast came about. McDuff and I said hello to each other. First time I met you at the event, and your story sort of resonated with me, and I thought the audience would love to hear more about you and what you've been through, what you've built over the years, what you've contributed to the industry, and to connecting people together through language. Now, a software engineer for over 20 years, you ended up running Google Translate. How does somebody land something like this? What did you have to do? Is it accident? Is it at the right time, at the right place? What happened?
It was kind of accidental. As I said, I had a lot of experience. I was a generalist as a software developer. I did a lot of things. Whatever my employer of the moment happened to want me to build, I built for many years. About 5 years in at Google, I was a little restless with the project I was on. And I just happened to see a peer, same level of management, sitting alone in a cafeteria, and sat down and had a little chat with him. And he had recently changed positions, moved to a new project. And I chatted with him and said, so how did you go about finding a new project? And he said, well, he had talked to various senior executives and asked them what was available. And he didn't mention one name of one senior executive I liked a lot. And I said, did you talk to that person? And he said, oh, yeah, I talked to him. But the only thing he had open was Google Translate. You know, that doesn't sound like there'd be much to do. And I found that night I couldn't sleep thinking, there's an opening for a new leader in Google Translate. So it so happened that I had, as a hobby, started learning a new language. I'd started learning Welsh that year. And I was just like listening to recordings in the car, and I'd made plans to go to a summer course to learn Welsh. So I went and talked to this executive who I knew. He knew me. And I think that little bit of evidence of my genuine interest in language helped close the deal. And he put me on the Google Translate team. And that is where I stayed for the final 12 years at Google.
So obviously you were drawn to languages.
Yes.
You know, from what you were saying, you were learning Welsh. Why Welsh?
Well, I'm of Welsh ancestry, which if you're familiar with the language, my last name does give it away. There's about five last names in Wales, and Hughes is one of them. I'm exaggerating. But I had been on a trip to Wales with my family and encountered the language, saw it used and heard it spoken, and that got me intrigued. I was able to visit the village that my great-great-great-grandparents lived in, and so I just got curious, wanted to learn it, and it was a good hobby, and listening to recordings during my commute was a good use of that time.
And did you learn it?
Yeah, I got fairly competent in it. I got to the point where I could read a beginner's novel. Yeah, I could. I kind of knew most of the grammar. I never ended doing much with it, but it was a great experience learning it. And I did go to a summer camp thing a couple of years in a row where I met a lot of people who were also interested in this rather niche language. It was great fun. And it gave me kind of a library of linguistic peculiarities, because it has its own quirks that many languages don't.
And for the audience, how similar Welsh is to English? Is it? I'm assuming it's Latin-based.
Not at all. An analogy I use, it's about as close as maybe Russian. You know, it's also an Indo-European language, but really not a lot of overlap.
It's a complex thing to learn, then.
Well, it's just different. I mean, I say as different. It's not like Russian, but I would say the distance in terms of linguistic similarity is probably comparable. It's just another language in the Indo-European language family. The Celtic languages are completely separate from the Germanic and Romance. So it is not terribly similar to English. I don't think it's terribly difficult either. It looks difficult. People find it intimidating when they look at it for all the consonants and they hear the funny sounds. But the grammar's not actually super complicated.
You know, I've been... First time I was in Ireland, I was through the Dublin airport, and I saw the Gaelic language written at a separate on signs in their communication, and also the announcements are in both official languages, Gaelic and English. It was quite fascinating. I've heard of Gaelic, I never heard it as an actual language spoken. I've got a lot of Irish friends in North America, but nobody speaks the language anymore. It was fascinating to hear.
Some people do. It's small, but it's not nobody.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the percentage is tiny, but the people I've known they hear about it, but they don't. I mean, I was married to an Irish girl. She didn't speak any of it. So
yeah. Well, I found the history of minority languages is really interesting. I as part of learning Welsh, I read some of the history, and to oversimplify the history, every 100 to 200 years. People declare that Welsh is on the brink of extinction because everybody's speaking English and nobody cares anymore. And then there's a big push to revive it, and it comes back. And then 100 years later, they declare it's almost dead again. A fascinating fact I found is that there are actually more Welsh speakers in Wales today than there were in 1800. As a percentage, it's much lower. But as the population has grown, the number of people actually speaking the language is pretty substantial. And if you go to North Wales, especially, you hear it spoken everywhere. It's really in use, and I think they're doing a great job reviving it. And from what I understand, Ireland is trying to do the same thing to revive the Irish language.
Totally. Now, what was your first moment, if you don't mind, Macduff, that you truly, grasped that what translation could mean to people at scale? Like, we talk about translation as to from the Babylon days till now, it's a one-on-one kind of a job. And at some point, you must have gone through this and said, okay, if I put this at scale, it could change people's lives, the world, etc. Have you thought about that as you were going through this?
Wow. There were many moments. I think I always, from the moment I first even knew what machine translation was, said, wow, this has huge potential. One of the things you see right away is it's very asymmetric, depending on what your native language is. It means something very different to a native English speaker than it does to someone who maybe is a monoglot speaker of some minority language with little presence on the internet. So I always tried to relate to how much more important it is to people who don't speak English. For those of us who speak English well, the internet is very friendly. you know, you feel like you go to the internet, you say, all the world's information is at my fingertips. It's all here. Everything is, almost everything everyone has written or thought or knows is right there. I can find it. So for us, it's kind of a niche thing that occasionally you run into, like, oh, here's an article written in German or French or Chinese or something. You say, hey, isn't it great that now I can actually get a little bit extra beyond that? The big thing I always tried to relate to at work was how different it is for someone who's, say, only languages, maybe Vietnamese or something, some language with much, much less present, where you go to the internet and there's very little there that's friendly to you and only a little niche, and you know there's this ocean of information that you can't access. And so the first big promise of machine translation was opening that enormous ocean of information in the big languages and making it available to everyone. And in the early days, when I first joined the translate team, quality of machine translation wasn't fantastic, but it was good enough that you could understand something, and you could go from zero understanding of a wall and text in front of you to understanding, okay, I get what this is about. I get what it's trying to tell me. So the first big thing was about opening access to the internet to people who could not get at most of it. There were many other instances of cases where people talked about the way machine translation had changed their life, where around once a year or so, we'd get an email from somebody saying, I ended up getting married because of somebody I started communicating with through Google Translate. That was exciting. You'd also hear stories of medical emergencies resolved because machine translation was just good enough to get through to somebody, say, like, you know, where are you feeling the pain or what medications are you taking, and get an answer. So from time to time, it could save a life. Someone's lost in a country where the public services aren't very good, and able to get through and solve a problem, deal with their lost wallet and their lost passport and so forth. Many of these things opened up. So there wasn't one moment when I said, aha, it's valuable, but there was a steady stream of stories, anecdotes coming in of people's lives and communities being changed. I learned quickly how strongly people felt about being included in the digital world, because one of the jokes I made about customer complaints was we get two top customer complaints. One, this translation is wrong. And the other, why don't you support my community's language? You know, often expressed in very spicy, emotional terms. You know,
colorful words.
People were, once they realized this existed, they really wanted it for their local community's language. And that's part of why a big push to make our products truly global was to try to see what would it take to get every language on the planet. You know, had a long way to go even when I left. I think we had about 40 languages when I started, got to 200 around the time I left, but there are still 6,000 or so languages on Earth, and it's still quite a ways to go, quite an exciting adventure to really make first formerly machine translation systems, now AIs generally, able to speak all the languages of the world and include everybody. I think it's still a very inspiring vision.
Absolutely. And you know, I was reading a little bit about yourself. I was doing the research on this conversation. Your years at Acrobat, you know, the Acrobat years at Adobe kind of thing, and it's sort of, it's almost a parallel to what you've seen at Translate. And what I mean by that is PDF became critical infrastructure to the world. And now Translate almost became, well, it is a critical infrastructure. Now everybody uses it. Do you see the parallel there or no?
Yeah, I think there's something there. I've always been interested in how information technology can change the world, and thinking about it at a high level while executing at whatever level, you know, the job is there in front of me to do at the time. Yeah, what happened at Adobe, one of my last big pushes there was to get PDF accepted by governments as a standard for preservation of information. That was, yes, the parallel is sort of, the technology was kind of ready. You could see it's there. It can do the job. Everything you can put in a paper document, you can now put in a digital document. What does it really get to the, what does it take to get to the point where people trust it? And where you say it's no longer necessary to maintain warehouses full of paper and deliver truckloads of paper to people when you need to exchange information. It seemed to many of us like this transforms the world when you can stop cutting down whole forests full of trees just to store all this information in paper. It was much more complicated than it looked at first. And it was a great experience talking to people in government and other very sensitive industries where really accurate retention of information is so important, discovering all the problems they had, the concerns they had, and saying, how do you make it so that this technology isn't just something that seems to work 99.9% of the time, but you can trust practically 100% of the time. It was a big change, and it was one of the exciting things. I had a stretch of a year when I was flying out to Washington almost every month to meet with people in that field. And yeah, it did change the world. It's hard for a lot of people to even remember how dubious it seemed at one time that you could trust your computers to store all of your important documents. Could, if there's a court case, can you trust that all the records of the court case can be stored digitally, and that if you look at them 5 years later, you'll see the same thing you saw before? In regulation, if a pharmaceutical company generates millions of pages of documents about the experiments and trials about their drug, again, can you trust 5, 10, 15 years later or 100 years later that you can still read the document? So yeah, I think it was more access of information through time as opposed to translation, which is access of information across cultural boundaries. But the same thing is there, is making information more available to more people.
Now, you reminded me, I was flipping through the YouTube channels the other day, and I saw this YouTube video about how much paper still exists in government. And
yeah,
it's amazing. Like, a lot of the forms filled by various departments and various clerks everywhere still being filled on paper in some cases, not all cases, obviously. But that, even with that small amount of cases that they're still on paper, still a lot of paperwork is being generated.
Yeah. Well, that's...
In fact, somebody was talking about where the forms are stored below a building. I can't remember. I'm not familiar with the government, but some building below the building, there was a huge warehouse where they keep these forms, and they happen to have a flood or something, and the paper is gone, or some of it damaged. I have no idea what happened there. But...
Well, the technology can provide the tools. People have to actually put in the effort to use them and make that change. Yeah, I recall hearing the story about a year and a half ago. They were trying to accelerate the retirement of a lot of government employees and found that it took like months to process retirement because that was still being done through paper forms. So yeah, it does take time for these things to
go through
that and to complete the change. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, the world doesn't flip on a switch kind of thing. It has to take time. It takes time for people to convert from what they're doing classically to what you want them to do in the future. Now, when you took over the translate function, the Google Translate function in 2012, I believe, statistical machine translation was at the time state of the art. Can you walk us through how that system actually worked? Not from an engineering perspective, maybe from an engineering perspective. Some of the engineers on the call here will probably appreciate that. So the listeners who are not familiar with the industry, how did it work?
Sure. So the first phase was finding parallel data. So the first thing was crawling the web and finding pairs of web pages that appeared to be translations of each other. So let's take, I'll take English and French for all my examples. So you find web pages in French that look very similar to a web page in English, and you use lots of clues like numbers and metadata and names and things match up. The length of the document is the same. Run a process to break into sentences that look like they're probably translations of each other. You get this big database of pairs of sentences that are probably translations. Then it would go through and find individual words and phrases that appeared often on both sides of translation pairs. So you find the word dog in English appears where the word chien in French appears a lot. And you build this database that if you've got a certain English word, you're likely to see this other word in French on the other side. And you extend from single word to two words to three words to up to, I think, got to maybe five or six words. And you calculate statistics. You just say, if this word appears in English, you now have a probability of various French words appearing in the French. So there's a good chance that that word or phrase is a translation in French of that English word or phrase. And that's literally statistics. You've got numbers, probabilities that they appear. Now, when you go and type something in English in the translation box, the software would go and break that down into one word, two word, three word, and so word phrases, look up statistics and say what words or phrases in French are likely to appear on the other side. So then it would have a table of likely to appear French words and phrases in a translation. Then it would say, how can we stitch them together to make something that kind of sounds like French. And that's the second, the final phase called a language model. So it is trained on lots and lots and lots of French and knows, given any collection of 1 to 5 or 6 words, what words are likely to follow. So using that, it can statistically calculate, well, of these things that are likely to appear in translation, what ways of ordering them, putting them together, make sense? And finally come up with something that would say there's a good probability that this is a reasonable translation of the English, and it would show it to you. So this worked well enough to be useful for some language pairs, right? It was very, very exciting in its day. You know, we went from when you compare it to the older, even older technology of rule-based technology, where software engineers sat down next to linguists and tried to write out the rules step by step. How do you translate? This worked massively better. And it worked well enough to be really useful in some cases.
Now, you know, it sounds like to me, like the early model, at least, it was probability based.
Yes.
Plus, you probably used billions of data points, meaning that parallel webs that you're talking about.
For big language pairs, it was billions. Yeah.
And what did it take back then to add another language? Like, where did you source the content from?
It was a lot of work, and it was really hard. And because we had to find parallel data, it got harder and harder as you got to languages with less and less presence on the internet. So roughly the ease of adding a language was proportional to how much authentic high quality text in that language existed on the internet. So there were a few languages that had a lot. At the time, as I recall, something like half the internet was English, or a very, very large percentage. Then the rest was, a large part of it was just a handful of languages, the big European languages, Chinese, Japanese, and a few others. Then it started falling off really, really fast, very, very small amounts. So it was very, very difficult to add languages. Each language after about the 40th or so got much, much more difficult. We started having to hire native speakers of the languages to get them to assist. So in addition to the problem of finding more data, there was the problem of evaluation. Even how do you tell if it's good? You need really good references, and finding people who could even evaluate the quality was quite a challenge.
Now, the early models, obviously, you had like 500 million people use the...
Yeah, the numbers depending whether you're talking 1 day, 7 day, 30 day active, depending on how hard you work to remove overlaps between different products. I don't remember the details of calculation, but it was certainly hundreds of millions. Sometimes we came up with a billion, depending on how we counted.
Now, McDuff, for most of us who use Google Translate, and I'm one of them, you use it free. Like, there was no payment for that. Was that a revenue generation or generating product for Google, or is it part of the overall offering of product?
Directly. So the consumer product labeled Google Translate was free always. There, through Google Cloud, there was the API, which did cost money and made a pretty good amount of money. But what I always told people then was, the company's investment in the technology was about a lot more than just directly making money from the service. It was about transforming how people access information. And I don't want to claim too much foresight in hindsight, but I think a lot of people had the insight that if you could solve translation, it would mean big things. And the expression AI complete was tossed around, that like translation is AI complete. If you could solve translation, you'd have solved AI. A lot of people had that hunch that this was bigger than just providing a translation service. And of course, with the discovery of the transformer, or the invention of the transformer architecture by the Google Brain team, that proved to be way more true than any of us imagined. It really did turn out that working on translation unlocked a lot of AI capabilities, which is what we're seeing changing the world so fast today.
Yeah. Now, speaking of architecture, did you notice, like, at that stage early on, that there are some architectural issues that you probably, the mode or the model that you're currently using early on, it cannot solve, and you probably need another review of the architecture down the road, and hence we'll get into neural MT, etc. down the road.
Yes, I went in not knowing any details of how the architecture worked. I learned fast as I could, got very immersed. I spent a lot of time. We had a debugger then that when there was a bad translation, you could get in and see sort of what went wrong. You know, what were the probabilities assigned to various possible translations? What came out was coming out of the language model and so forth. It did become fairly clear fairly quickly that there were just limitations of how well the statistical model could ever perform. I remember, for example, there was a big class of errors we called negation errors, where we just get the polarity of a thing backwards. Some languages like double negatives and some don't. A language I know fairly well is German. German has this nice word, kein. Yeah, ein means one or a. Kein means none or no. And so, like, you say, I don't have a book. You say, ich habe kein Buch. No, I have no money. Ich habe kein Geld. Well, the way that works in translation, you're translating between German and English, sometimes it would almost be a coin flip whether it included a not in the output or not, or whether it included that kein in the output or not. And you could see this is a catastrophic error. If you drop or add a not where it doesn't belong, you've completely reversed the meaning of the sentence. And you'd look in the debugger and see it was like, well, 51% probability assigned to the wrong translation and 49% probability assigned to the correct translation. And the model kind of has no idea. There's a huge difference. They mean completely different things. Or another thing I would see often is the top probability is something that's wrong, but then the next five in order are all correct, but they all have individually, they have slightly less probability than the one that's completely wrong. And the model had no way to say, look, these next four or five candidates are all very similar. You should try to, you know, treat them as one and say they outvote the top one. It just couldn't do that. It didn't have a sense of these two are very similar and therefore their probabilities should be joined together, whereas these two are very different and need to be treated differently. So we could all see there was a problem. And some people on the team knew even in 2012, there were a small number of people on the team who said, it's going to have to be neural networks. It's going to have to be neural networks. Over the next few years, more and more people started saying we needed to look at neural networks. Some people started actually doing experiments with it. But yeah, I think almost everyone on the team could see something big had to change at some point.
Correct. And just a context for the audience, November 2016, Google launched GNMT, that's Google Neural Machine Translation, and that replaced the entire SMT, the Statistical Machine Translation backend. And they did an error reduction of 55 to 85% in some language pairs overnight. So NMT had a positive impact. McDuff yes. also was named as a co-author on a landmark 2016 GNMT research paper along Jeff Dean and 29 other researchers, cross-functional effort at the highest level. So this is not a single individual who probably was more of a research team that came up with this idea of moving to neural, which obviously had a positive impact. And, you know, it's like everything else in life, I guess, the more we know, the more technology comes along, you're probably going to evaluate it, assess it, and see if it makes sense, positive or negative, and where to use it. I'm assuming this context that I just mentioned here had something to do with the move to neural, beside the fact that we've detected already through the story that SMT is lacking in some cases.
Yes. So I think by 2016, everybody working on machine translation knew about the limits. Many people had the intuition that neural networks were likely to be the solution. We had seen things like word-to-vec word embeddings and some things done with LSTMs, long short-term memory networks, that looked promising. That event in 2016, I'd say that was the most exciting year of my career. It was a great collaboration between research and product people. So the team I was leading was the product team, and there was a research team under Google Brain, and there was a great team there that was doing experiments, and they just had a passionate commitment to wanting to see their work launch, which in research groups at any company, it varies how much researchers care about seeing their work in production. Some people are content to just publish a paper and say, if the product people want to use it, they can look at our paper. Others just really, really want to closely collaborate. And this was a team that really wanted to closely collaborate. So people from the Google Translate team and from the Google Brain team worked very, very closely together. This is all covered, by the way. I hope you read the great article in New York Times magazine that was written about it. It was a wonderful collaboration, great experience. So the researchers brought the experience with neural network architectures and how to train them efficiently and so forth. And we brought the practical experience of how do people use things. So we had to deal with questions like, how fast does it have to be? You know, in the first draft, the neural translation, if I recall correctly, I think it was hundreds of times slower than the statistical translations. If your background is engineering, immediate red flag, whoa. Speed. We care about speed. But then we have the question, how much does it really matter? You know, people like the translation to be fast. Is it okay if it's a little slower? Will anyone even notice? We had to deal with practical things like, what do you do if you get a severe error, right? So we knew early on neural on average is going to be a lot better, but machine translation, like all AI and machine learning things, can make surprising, sometimes shocking mistakes. What are we going to do if it's translating something wrong? Then the product had features that were hard to replicate with neural translation. Like it used to be you could hover over a particular word or click on a word and it would show you the various candidate phrases that the statistical algorithm had come up with as candidate translations. Well, that didn't exist in neural anymore. We had to wrestle with, does that matter? Do we need to replicate that feature or can we just drop it? So lots and lots of things to do to take this clearly exciting technology and make sure it's usable for hundreds of millions of people. So really exciting time.
Now, for the internal team, though, McDuff, correct me if I'm wrong from what I've read, is the decision meant like to swap. It's not just a swap of technology here. You've got some engineers, you've got some staff, you've got some team members. It had an impact on the human aspect of the team. Am I correct by saying that? Or how did you manage that if it was yes?
Well, I do recall there were some people on the team, really, really good engineers, who didn't like neural networks.
Those are the skeptics, right?
Hard to believe now. Huh? Not exactly skeptics. They just said, I don't find this interesting. You know, people who had found the algorithms of statistical translation really, really interesting to work on. It was the kind of problem that was in their sweet spot that they enjoyed. And they said, well, you know, I like programming things to work better. I like developing algorithms and pouring data into a training thing and watching some black box results come out that look like a black box would understand. That's not interesting to me. So some people did choose to go do other things. But overwhelmingly, I think people were just happy that the system was working better. I mean, people were, well, really, really thrilled. I remember a fair number of people on the team were native speakers of languages other than English. And I remember many people just like walking on air around the building. I just tried it on my language, my native language, and now it reads correctly. You know, Chinese now sounds like Chinese instead of a computer's attempt to imitate Chinese. Yeah. And so people were mostly very, very excited about the opportunity and the being part of a change in how people can work with language, a change in how
100%. You know,
what technology can do. Yeah,
absolutely. 100%. Like on the, you know, we talked about a little a second ago, you just mentioned 80 to 90% of the web is just intent languages, right? So now that you have neural machine translation running, what does Google Translate actually mean for the other billions of people that there are on the other side of the wall of those 10 languages? Did it make it better to add new languages now, easier? Because we had some issues with statistical, meaning adding a new language, it was a little difficult because you didn't have access to data. Did that get solved?
Yeah. Help you? No? What was happening around the time I left was the pace was picking up from a couple of things. One is there were some very big open public efforts to gather data over long tail languages. So there are some large data sets that have been generated in the open as collaborations among various companies and nonprofits and so forth. There's a lot more open data available for lots of languages because lots of people recognize the importance of this. And there's been a lot of collaboration. A fun thing about translation research, especially, is how much collaboration there is across companies. Like it's like all the companies and governments and everyone wants this to work. So even though there is competition, there's a lot of cooperation too. So there's a lot of open source data available now. The other big thing is the large language models, the AI models being trained on everything. So a big limitation of how statistical machine translation was trained, and even how neural translation continued to be trained for several years after it was invented, was each language was trained as a separate unit initially. So you would train the English to German pair, you'd train the English to Vietnamese pair, you'd train the English to Quechua pair, and each time you're training on a tinier and tinier amount of data. Large language models are trained on all the languages and all the data you can get together. And the fact is you can learn things across languages. Many languages are very similar to each other. As you get down to long, long tail, you get to pairs of languages that are almost the same. When we trained each language pair separately, they couldn't learn from each other. But the large language models effectively learn about all languages at once. So while they're learning about a particular language, they're benefiting from the things they've learned from all the similar languages. They have learned generally what translation is. So there's this rising tide lifting all the boats that the large language models can get a lot of languages better, and the average scores across lots of small languages I believe can improve, although I've been away from the details for a couple of years now. But from everything I see, I think that trend is continuing.
It's continuing. Now, like, for instance, in the Arabic language, there are various, I want to say, sub-languages in the Arabic language.
Yes.
You've got the Gulf states, you've got Egypt, you've got the, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, Libya, Morocco, all these countries, they've got their own subset of Arabic, and debatable as to which one goes first kind of thing. But is that what you mean, these language combinations?
That would be an example, right? And of course, whether things are called different languages or not is often as
debatable
a political question. And if you're relying on formal language codes and you have to wait for some standards body to decree whether or not, say, Egyptian Arabic is a different Arabic from Levant Arabic or Tunisian Arabic or whatever, I'm not an expert on those things, that really limits you. And it gets very, very hard to chop it down and say what goes on in our Egyptian Arabic test set, what goes in our Levantine Arabic test set, and so forth. That gets really hard. With a large language model, though, when any of the big companies training their frontier models is seeing lots and lots, I assume, of Arabic text, has in it some context about where the text is from. And so I would hope, I don't know any Arabic myself, I haven't tried this, but if you go to one of the top frontier models, one of the top public AIs, and say, translate this into Arabic appropriate for Egypt, translate this into Arabic appropriate for Lebanon, translate this into Arabic appropriate to Syria, to Tunisia, my guess is they will probably do something useful. Now, exactly how good it is, I don't know. But the more data they see, the more skilled they will get at that, even without somebody setting up some big training run saying, here is the training data for this type of Arabic, that type of Arabic, that type of Arabic. They are becoming much more flexible and doing a lot of things kind of automatically.
Now, my understanding is when we're talking about machine translation in general, biases were a problem because the training corpus was the internet, if you know that's what we started the conversation with, which reflects in a lot of cases centuries of a human inequality or misplaced priority, whatever you want to call it. Did the team that you worked with, how were they able to fix this, if they fixed it, or was it a challenge? How did you attack?
I would say we addressed it, and I think we mitigated the issue. It's a very, very hard problem. I went to a couple of conferences on AI and ethics, and I read a lot of papers and talked to a lot of people and brought in guest speakers. The thing that presented the issue most prominently that got a lot of public attention was gender bias. So English has gendered pronouns, but doesn't gender much else. Some languages very heavily gender almost all nouns. Some languages require even the first person has to be gendered, like, you know, to say I am happy is different if you're male or female. Other languages have almost no gender marking. And so when you translate between them, well, this is just one example of where when you translate into a language that requires you to specify something that doesn't have to be specified in the source language, there's many examples of that. But the one that went viral on the internet many times, and I don't know who to credit for originally exposing it, but it went out a lot, was the equivalent of he or she is a doctor, he or she is a nurse. A number of languages where the personal pronoun is gender neutral, you'd say that in the same way. And if you tried to translate to English, the translation would say he is a doctor, she is a nurse. Okay. So it's reflecting the statistics. It's reflecting that on the internet, you see more text about male doctors than female doctors and more text about female nurses than male nurses. That's what's in the text. And the reason that's in the text is because that's what's in the world. And that fact is, I would say, morally neutral. That's just the way it is. But what you are doing, this is an example of one kind of bias AI and machine learning systems can have, which is taking a 80-20, 90-10 difference and amplifying it into a 100-0 difference. Because if you translated, I think the Turkish sentence was, o bir doktor, perhaps a majority of mentions of doctors are male, although it's actually becoming close to 50% today. Interesting trend, but machine translation at the time would 100% of the time produce he is a doctor. So if you are using a machine translation system of that sort, it's going to subliminally present the idea, reinforce the idea that a doctor should be male. And that is not a healthy thing. And if you've got a service that hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people are using every day, it's your responsibility to think about what larger social impact do you have. So this was not just like, okay, our product is doing this one thing, but also thinking, well, if we as a corporation are going to be building lots of things like this that do more and more, ever more powerful things, we need to understand how to address this kind of problem. So that was really, really hard to address. We put a lot of time, some of our best, most driven, motivated engineers spent time on this rather than on many other things they could have been working on, like just increasing the average quality across lots of things. So we did come up with something to address specifically gender bias, which was detecting the case where gender was unspecified in the source but specified in the target, and offering people multiple choices and alternatives. And that worked fairly well. But the larger problem, I think, has become much more complicated in the era of big AIs serving multiple purposes, because large language models answering very general questions and having long conversations with people and performing tasks for people, which we're seeing today, all sorts of biases like that are going to exist. Those models are trained on just whatever is on the web and then fine-tuned according to the priorities of the developers who make them. And I think at all the big companies, they are trying to correct for the biases that they know about and care about. But even then, they introduce their own biases. Who decides what is important? You know, what sorts of things are worth fixing and which are not? That's a decision that has to be made. And that's something all the AI companies are wrestling with today. And some of them are fairly transparent to their credit about how they're doing it. But I don't think anybody thinks they've solved all those issues.
It's no, not yet. It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the team earlier. How big was the team was its peak when you were involved in it? How many employees?
We considered that confidential information, I think. But yeah, it wasn't thousands.
No, I'm just curious because...
Yeah, but yeah, we didn't talk about the number. We had various reasons. I think I'll just...
No, you helped through the shift a couple of times. And the last one in 2024 before we retired is that shift to LLM. And the question, you know, from your perspective, now that the team has been through two major technology shifts, how did the LLM, when it arrived, how did the team take that on? Did they have like the institutional muscle memories now or paradigm change to accommodate this change? Was it hard, or what do you think?
Well, the change was just beginning when I left, so I don't think I can speak to like how it really played out.
But
what I was seeing, well, it was beginning to change. The first thing was that the large language models were becoming better at translation than the dedicated machine translation systems. So they were huge. Of course, they took, you know, many months to train, and trained on virtually the entire internet and used enormous numbers of parameters. So they got really good at lots of things. The translation team worked very closely with the training teams for the large language models to make sure that they were good at many languages and good at translation. But it became clear that dedicated machine translation models were going to be downstream of large language models, that instead of training a machine translation model from scratch, you were simply going to let the large language model team create a model that can do everything with language and then distill that down to a translation system. The other thing is dealing with nuance in translation, contextual issues, and questions like gender bias and so forth, where there's multiple possible translations that differ in important ways. It became clear that what large language models and AIs could do is not just give you a translation, but talk about the translation with you. And I expect you've probably tried that with some of the big AIs. So if you go to a dedicated translation product and say, translate this, it'll give you primarily highlight one translation. Fine. But if you want to understand it deeply, you go to an AI and say, please suggest some possible translations and tell me about them. And it will do that. I hope you've done this.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And the big frontier models are quite good at this. They will say, okay, here are several ways you could translate it. Here's a very formal way. Or they might say, well, it depends on the gender of the doctor. If the doctor is a woman, you'd probably want to translate it like this. If not, if you're speaking Japanese, you can deal with formality. So, well, it can ask you, like, are you planning to say this to someone you have who you need to speak very formally to, or are you saying this to a friend or family member? In Japanese, it's different, right? So the fact that LLMs could sort of do this out of the box would change how you think about a machine translation product. So before AIs like that came out, we would look at a translation product and say, well, here's this long list of features I would like to add, like formality I just mentioned. What would it take to put an engineer on adding a formality feature in the product? Well, now you can, if you could just go to your AI and just say, tell me about the translation. It'll even unprompted tell you, hey, formality is an issue in this particular context and this particular language. So the thinking about how to develop a product changes dramatically now that these capabilities are in AIs.
Now, you've worked with, I mean, I saw you at the Global Psyche, so I'm sure you know about the language industry or the localization industry.
Yeah, I keep tabs on how things are going.
You see. In your opinion, and I know you're not directly involved right now, you're retired, but from what you know, is the professional translation industry making the right bets right now, do you think?
From what I hear, I would say yes. It's clear that machine translation has now changed all translation activity. Doing translation without the aid of a computer is almost unknown now. It would be like a mechanical engineer not using computers. I mean, just not a thing. The quality has gotten to the point where there's a large class of things where machine translation is fine. There is a bigger class where you need human post-editing, and other classes where human quality checks and spot checks may be enough. It seems what they are moving is into what people call agentic workflow. So having a number of agents that do various steps of the translation that check and research and check terminology and do things. That makes sense to me. Although I do know that there's a really interesting pair of papers that came out over about the past year. Some people from Google published a paper on iterative translation where you have a dedicated step, a research step, translation step, proofreading step, and a couple others. There was a paper in response from Amsterdam that said, well, actually, if you just tell your AI to translate multiple times, just translate it again, you actually do just as well. You don't actually even need to give it these details. So I think that is something to think about, is more raw power and repetition sometimes beats being smart. But overall, I think that's correct. So tailoring your workflow to the needs of a particular job seems to be the trend. The other thing, I think speech and video translation is the big frontier where there's a lot to learn. I think straight text translation is very well understood now, and it's asymptotically approaching solved, but it's in the video speech, dubbing, and those things that there's a lot more to learn. And then finally, one thing I thought you might ask me, is there anything surprised? Is if you had asked me 10 years ago where we would be, probably one thing that surprises me now is how far we are from conversational translation actually working. There was the hope always like, well, once you get machine translation to work pretty well, you'll be able to have a conversation with somebody speaking a different language and it'll just be totally naturally, just set your phone out and it'll just work. And it kind of works, but that's got a long way to go. I know it's a lot of progress has been made, but see, every 1 to 2 years, someone puts out a big paper saying we've got a big breakthrough here, but getting to the point where people can really use conversational translation every day, it's one of those things that seems to be getting farther away the more you work on it.
Is this your hope? Is this what you'd like to see? Conversational translation being more, I want to say, adequate?
Yeah, I would love to see that happen. But I appreciate now how difficult it really is. I've only a couple of times been in a situation of using a professional human interpreter and seeing how difficult it is even for humans and how difficult the conversation is even with the best professional interpreters. It's just an inherently very difficult thing to do really well. So I think we'll get there. And I know it works sometimes in certain limited cases, people are able to do it. But mass adoption of this seems to be some ways away still.
I've seen some demos. I've worked with some companies, McDuff, where what they're doing is they're taking the what I would call the simple part of the conversation and injecting LLM into it. So you'd hear it, hello, my name is so-and-so, and I'd like to speak to somebody about a certain topic. That is being handled by AI. As soon as the conversation and there's an AI detection process there, gets into something complex, they shoot it out to a person to talk to you.
Yeah, well, that's a really nice, that's in great product thinking from my point of view. It's like, figure out what it can actually do and say, okay, a large percentage of our time in say, a customer support call is on these boilerplate bits of conversation that it can handle and move forward. Yeah, I think that.
And I think that setting up that way, it means as we evolve, as the models evolve and learn more, then you can start increasing the exposure of that model to the normal conversation, I'm assuming. Now, McDuff, what do you say to somebody who's listening to us right now? Some of our audience, or a lot of our audience are translators. They're working from home remotely, etc. What do you say to them? They're mid-career translators. They're trying to figure things out, what the next few years is going to bring. What would you tell them?
Wow. Well, I don't know that I should be giving advice to translators. I've never worked as a translator.
Just your opinion.
But my opinion is understand the technology, use it. You need to be, and actually I would say anyone who does any kind of intellectual work, you need to understand the capabilities of these things because they will change your business. You need to be proficient in it and you need to be flexible and adaptable. The era when anybody could master a skill when they're in their early 20s and then simply apply that skill for 40 years and retire, I think that is gone. Like, to work in the 21st century economy, you need to be flexible and adaptable and always watching new technologies and learning how things change. From what I read, the growth of translator employment is slowing dramatically. Things are changing. You need to understand not just how to translate, but why people want to translate. And I think the big thing to keep an eye on is, are people giving up on translating content altogether? Why did people ever want to translate? So look at, say, a company that has a product. They want to develop marketing. They develop marketing materials. They develop customer support materials in their first language, let's say English. Then they say, okay, we'd better translate this content into many languages. Well, why? Does it matter anymore if now the person in, say, Thailand who buys your product and wants customer support is no longer going to look for a user manual that's been translated to Thai, but is instead going to go to one of the big commercial AIs and simply type in Thai, how do I fix this problem with my product? And an AI that has read the English user manual will produce step-by-step instructions to solve their problem in Thai. So I know this came up at Global Sake. People are talking about it. I think the more forward-thinking people are talking about this. So if your job was to translate from English to Thai, what value do you add now as a person who can understand English and produce fluent Thai text? Your value is changing. I'm not saying it's going away, but perhaps your value is more to the big AI companies that might want to get example training text about how to translate any user manual effectively into that language. How are things changing in that now people are seeing what is effectively translated text, but no one gets a log on it. There's no quality control on it. Company that originated the English text doesn't get a say in how the terminology was translated. People need to be aware of this. I think, again, the more forward-thinking people are aware and thinking hard, but I don't think people have solved how this works. What's happening with the information flow? The what do you and don't you as a business owner, as a consumer, have into what's going on with the language? Language experts are needed, but your expertise in these two languages may not be best applied to taking a translation task and taking language one, producing a bunch of language text in language two, and checking the box saying I'm done and throwing over the wall to somebody. You are part of an ecosystem where people are getting information. So I would say spend some time getting your head out of the translation task and looking into what problem you are solving for businesses and users and how you can
correct.
Help.
Correct. And that's quite the change, because for many years the translator has been on the receiving end of the content that needs to be changed, or moved to another language. The fact that now we're most translation companies and translation individuals who are in the profession are in a confusion state right now. Everybody is trying to figure out, what is my value? Where do I play a role? Where can I fit in from a journey perspective, customer's journey perspective? And you're right. You hit the nail on the head. Every conversation I've had is about, where do I create value? What value do I bring? And how do I quantify that value? How do I put a price on it? At the end of the day, everybody needs to work. And nobody's doing this as a philanthropist. Some people do. But some people need to work and put food on the table. These guys are working remotely from home and individual contributors to their families, etc. So they're probably trying to figure this out and figure out quickly, but you're absolutely correct. Don't wait, basically, for the content to arrive to you. You translate it. You may not have any coming to you in the future. You may want to go out and get involved in how do you solve a problem for a business. No, I want to thank you. This is a pretty awesome McDuff conversation that we've had today.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's been delightful talking to you. Fun reminiscing and looking forward.
Absolutely. And is there anything else that I haven't talked about that you would like to talk about?
No, this has been a great talk.
I really appreciate it.
Hope to see you again, maybe at another Global Sake.
Probably. I told Talia I'll make it next time if she invites me. So I'll be happy to participate.
Yeah.
I just want to thank you, McDuff Hughes, for this contribution to this conversation. This is what this channel is about, is having this type of conversation with people such as yourself. And A, connecting the human part of the conversation to the intellectual part, to the professional part, and expose these, I would call, gems in our industry, these forward-thinking individuals. These individuals, although that you retired, you contributed heavily to the industry. And when I say the industry, I'm talking about languages in general across the globe, not specifically the localization industry in this case, which is right. You've contributed to the localization industry as well, but I'm just using it in a more global sense from that context. I want to thank you again, McDuff Hughes, for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me, Robin.
Appreciate it. For everybody, thanks for watching us on YouTube, and also thanks for listening in on our podcast. And if you're reading our blog post where I summarize these conversations, robinayoub.blog, thanks for subscribing. And from me, Robin Ayoub and McDuff Hughes, we thank you so much for listening in, and we'll see you at the next episode.